This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, August 5th, 2010. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, a late bloomer. Amy Clampett was born in 1920, but she didn't publish her first poem until she was 58 years old. In her 60s, after her first book was published, the poetry world took notice, and she went on to publish four more books before her death in 1994. Amy Clampett lived for a couple of years near Lenox, Massachusetts, in a house that is currently occupied by the poet Tess Taylor. Tess, what are you doing in Amy Clampett's house?
Well, Amy, as we know, was a late bloomer, and she came to light in the poetry world late, but she skyrocketed up and pretty soon had won honors like the Guggenheim, and then I think in 1990 or so, she won a MacArthur.
Uh-huh.
Now, she and her partner, Hal, had this lovely sum of $500,000, and they bought a house in Lenox, Massachusetts, where some friends of theirs lived, and which was close to Tanglewood.
Mm-hmm.
She was a great music lover. Unfortunately, shortly after buying this house, she got cancer and very soon after died. So the house has been left as a kind of preserve for other poets to work in, and I'm living here as this year's poet.
So you're sort of living among her stuff and her books and her
personality, yes.
And what is that like?
It's very wonderful because the books stare down at you and kind of keep you company and remind you of the rigor and liveliness of Amy Clampett's mind. She was a great reader of Wordsworth and Keats and of many, many, many contemporary poets of her day, which was, I guess, the 80s and 90s. And she's got this kind of wide-ranging, eclectic, but also deeply read selection. Birding manuals, a book called A Natural History of Vacant Lots, which is all about how to identify weeds. She's got this great personality that's kind of coming through her library.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to listen to one Amy Clampett poem together, but before we do that, can you tell us a little bit more about her, in particular, why she came so late to poetry?
She'd been a poet early in her life. Written poetry, and abandoned it for writing novels, none of which were published. And I haven't read them myself, but the people that I've read say that they, you know, they also don't lift off. It's not as if they were just neglected.
They're not so good, in other words.
Well, again, I haven't read them. But nevertheless, she had spent a life in literature and near literature, reading deeply and cultivating a very astute sensibility so that when she began to write poetry, she was able to kind of shape some of these qualities of intense observation and her sort of humorous knack for detail.
And an incredibly close observer of the natural world.
Well, yes, and Amy Clampett did spend a lot of her life working as a librarian for the Audubon Society. And it's sort of useful to think of the intense attention that she brings to the natural world and to the subjects for her poetry as a kind of a birder's attention, that sort of intense quick focus and suspended attention that's almost heaping on of attention in order to try to make something very fleeting recognizable.
And speaking of birds, this, what we're listening to now, is the sound of a hermit thrush, which is the title of the poem that we're going to listen to. Amy Clampett, she worked at the Audubon Society, you said, but she was really big on birds in her poetry as well.
Yeah, that sense of things being aloft and alight and also fleeting and fragile. She's very into the fleeting and the fragile, and I think birds capture a lot of what her sense of a poem is.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have a recording from the Library of Congress of Amy Clampett reading A Hermit Thrush, and let's listen to how she introduces it.
The setting is the coast of Maine, specifically a bar island, which means that it's an island at high tide. At low tide, it becomes a peninsula. And one of my favorite places in the world, I suppose, is a spot where, when the tides are right, I like to go for picnics. And that's the setting of A Hermit Thrush.
Now, it's a fairly long poem, but since it's already available in its entirety in the audio form on poetryfoundation.org, I'm going to take liberties here and interrupt it from time to time to ask you a question or two.
Okay, wonderful.
So here's the first part of A Hermit Thrush.
Nothing's certain. Crossing on this longest day, the low tide uncovered isthmus, scrambling up the scree slope of what at high tide will be again an island, to where a decade since well-being staked the slender, unpremeditated claim that brings us back year after year, lugging the makings of another picnic, the cucumber sandwiches, the sea air sanctified fig Newtons. There's no knowing what the slamming seas, the gales of yet another winter may have done.
So those were the first two sentences, and I have to say I was so delighted by the sea air sanctified fig Newtons. She has a sense of humor.
She definitely does. A sense of self-mockery, I think.
Yeah, and also there's a sense of, I guess, contentedness, a well-being in the poem that's announced very early on. She says, a decade since well-being staked the slender, unpremeditated claim that brings us back for this picnic year after year. I think it's somewhat unusual to begin a poem with a sense of happiness.
Right, it's almost cozy, and that coziness seems, if it were handled wrong, it could be dangerous for the poem's well-being.
Yeah. Okay, let's go on.
Still there, the gust-beleaguered single spruce tree, the ant-thronged, root-snelled moss, grass, and clover tufted underneath it, edges frazzled raw, but like our own prolonged attachment, holding. Whatever moral lesson might commend itself, there's no use drawing one. There's nothing here to seize on as exemplifying any so-called virtue, holding on despite adversity, perhaps, or any no more than human tendency, stubborn adherence, say, to a wholly wrong-headed tenet. Though to hold on in any case means taking less and less for granted, some few things seem nearly certain, as that the longest day will come again, will seem to hold its breath, the months-long exhalation of diminishment again begin.
So this section was very curious to me because here she is sort of comparing her own long-term relationship with this gust-beleaguered single spruce tree and at the same time saying that that's not a valid comparison, within the same breath almost.
She's constantly doing that. There's a way in which she can say something in very precise language and then she kind of quickly unravels the very thing that she's talked about, so that there's a sort of a pageantry of the language with an awareness that perhaps this arrangement is fragile and futile and really hasn't captured anything. She's playing with that ability of the mind to kind of put something forward and take it away.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I notice about this particular passage is that she's using words like snelled.
The ant-thronged, root-snelled moss, grass, and clover tufted underneath it.
Which is really funny to think that it's something that sounds kind of remarkable, a snell, but when you look it up, it's a fishhook. She's got a way of sort of using remarkable language for things that are in a way mundane and making you kind of have a play between the registers of her speech. Another thing that's great about this particular passage in terms of the richness of language that she's using,
mm-hmm.
We've got root snelled with two L's, moss, grass, tuffet.
Root snelled moss, grass, and clover tuffet underneath it. Edges frazzled raw.
And frazzled, all in a stanza. All of these kind of words that even in themselves have a kind of a richness. There's this double consonant that's kind of heaping up sonic gusto.
Okay, let's go on. Let's go to the next part of the poem. The next long sentence in the poem, actually.
Right, they're all long sentences.
Last night you woke me for a look at Jupiter, that vast cinder wheeled unblinking in a bath of galaxies. Watching, we traveled toward an apprehension all but impossible to be held on to, that no point is fixed, that there is no foothold, but roams untethered, save by such snells, such sailor's knots, such stays and guy wires as are mainly of our own devising. From such an empyrean, aloof seraphic mentors urge us to look down on all attachment, on any bonding, as in the end untenable.
So in this passage, she directly introduces her partner.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens?
Then she sort of seems to say that the relationship is kind of unsteady enough. You know, I mean, there's a lot of memento mori in this, a sense that anything could unravel, that, it would just take a strong winter storm for it all to fall apart.
Yeah, that no point is fixed, that there's no foothold, but roams untethered save by such snells.
Yeah, there's our word snell again.
There's those snells.
Yeah, those fishhooks keeping us together.
So what is her argument at this point, then?
Well, I mean, I think she's announced it at the beginning of the poem that nothing is certain, and that the certainty that we make is sort of made by the almost artificial mending that we do, which she then compares to the mending that the earth does, so that there's something very natural about our desire to to snell ourselves to the world, as it were. But one of her arguments as a poet, one of her prime kinds of poetics is that attention is a form of repair. This verbal attentiveness, even as it's calling into our awareness this fragility, she's also showing us that this kind of attention can be a form of mending.
Base as it is, from year to year, the earth's sore surface mends and rebinds itself, however and as best it can, with thread of cinquefoil, tendril of the magenta beech pea, trammel of bramble, with easings, mulchings, fragrances, the gray-green bayberry's cool poultice. And what can't finally be mended, the salt air proceeds to buff and rarefy. The lopped carnage of the seaward spruce clump weathers lustrous to wood silver.
So not everything can be mended, but nature takes care of it anyway.
Right. I mean, there's that same force that wounds it, but kind of buffs it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the good old Maine that can knock down all the trees in the storm in the winter and then, you know, in the summer sort of bleach them into gorgeous sculptures.
And in the background, at all times, we're meant to be thinking of a human relationship, of a long-term human relationship.
You know, I wouldn't think of this necessarily as a whole allegory. It's sort of more of a shimmering allegory. And I do think it leaves in tension our ability to think how much our human efforts are like cinquefoil, which, by the way, is another one of those great Amy Clampett words that really just means ground cover.
With thread of cinquefoil.
She's talking about a very basic, very rude kind of plant, a pigweed, really.
She didn't use the word pigweed, I noticed.
Yeah. She surely didn't use the word pigweed. I mean, I'm not sure pigweed necessarily is a cinquefoil, but a cinquefoil is definitely a ground cover that binds in a very humble way. It's a beautiful word for a sort of ecologically humble kind of plant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably the comparison is that she's interested in is there, is that there's this sort of humility to the human gesture of holding it all together.
Okay, let's listen now to the last long sentence in the poem, and when we finally hear from the hermit thrush.
Little is certain, other than the tide that circumscribes us, that still sets its term to every picnic. Today we stayed too long again and got our feet wet. And all attachment may prove at best, perhaps, a broken, a much mended thing. Watching the longest day take cover under a monk's cowl overcast with thunder, rain, and wind, then waiting, we drop everything to listen as a hermit thrush distills its fragmentary, hesitant, in the end, unbroken music. From what source, beyond us or the wells within, such links perceived arrive, diminished sequences so uninsistingly not even human? There's hardly a vocabulary left to wonder, uncertain as we are of so much in this existence, this botched, cumbersome, much mended, not unsatisfactory thing.
That's a really impressive ending, an image of a life lived as something botched, cumbersome, and then much mended, but not an unsatisfactory thing.
And I think she also tries to answer the question, is nature a metaphor for what's going on? Is nature an allegory for what's going on in human life? And she says, from what source beyond us or the wells within? I mean, it's like almost a Wordsworthian sense of consciousness of this undecided, whether it's the inner or the outer life, or whether the inner life and the outer life kind of follow the same principles, if one stands in for one another.
But what is the hermit thrush doing in this poem? What role does the hermit thrush suddenly play?
Well, the hermit thrush is just surviving. And I think it's important also to notice, when I looked up the hermit thrush, that they're one of the only birds that can winter over in Maine. They actually can survive the assault of a Maine winter. So
you really did your research.
I think Amy would have known that, and I think she probably would have expected it of me. The hermit thrush is an attached being. It's not a migratory one. The hermit thrush has to change its food source kind of three times to make it through the winter. And so I think it's just that the song of the hermit thrush, which is kind of paradoxically fragmented and unbroken, just represents to her the work of surviving, really, and the kind of labor of attachment.
Mm-hmm. And since I'm so drawn to the allegory here, perhaps more than you are, she's suggesting the work of having a relationship. It's almost a cliche, but the work of mending and weaving and repairing relationships to make them long-lasting. You're uncomfortable with that, I can tell.
Yeah, well, I think, when she says, from what source such links perceived arrive, it's as if the hermit thrush is giving her the language to talk about her own act of mending. And what I like about that kind of thing is that she's not sure if she's just imagining that in as another link to hold her world together or whether it really is some kind of outer omen. And I think she kind of holds that intention in a way.
Thank you so much, Tess.
Thank you very much, Curtis. This is delightful.
Tess Taylor is a poet living in Amy Clampett's house near Lenox, Massachusetts. Her latest book, Tess Taylor's latest book, is The Misremembered World, published by the Poetry Society of America. You can read more poems by Amy Clampett on our website, poetryfoundation.org, where you can also listen to a few more of her poems on the Essential American Poets podcast. Just do a search for Clampett. That's spelled with two T's. Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.